There's an old saying, familiarity breeds contempt. And it's true, because the more you're around something, the more you see something, the more you experience something, the less special that thing becomes. You might remember several years ago when flat-screen TVs were first introduced to the world and how it just blew our minds that we would have a TV we could hang on the wall. But now, 10, 15 years later, we're not that impressed by those TVs because they're everywhere. They're here in the church. They're in the gas station. Chances are, if you've bought a TV in the past 5 or 10 years, it's been a flat-screen TV. They're just all over the place. They're very common. And because of that, they don't turn the heads like they used to. Or think about your cell phone. Back in the 90s, when these things first became real popular, they were only available to a select few people who could afford them. And you might remember back in the 90s seeing somebody on one of those old Motorola brick cell phones and how special that was, that they were on a phone that wasn't connected to their house. But times have changed, and now just about everybody has one of these phones. And many people like us have actually replaced our existing landlines in the house because these have just become so handy. And this cell phone, even though we call it a cellular telephone, is actually more a computer than it is a phone. I can get on the internet with this. We do our banking with this. You can do social media with this. It's email. It's a voice recorder. It's a GPS in case you're lost. And with your spare time, it's a telephone. It can make calls. But that's what's happened. Our phones have just become so common. But I'm told that phone in your pocket has more computing power than the NASA space shuttles when they were in service. But that's really not that impressive to us these days because they're everywhere. They're common. We get a new one every couple of years. Or consider air travel for just a moment, which statistically speaking is still the safest way to travel anywhere you're going. Even though you're at 30,000 feet in the air and you're going 500 miles an hour, you are safer there than in your car. But consider that just a couple of hundred years ago, that was a dream. There's no way mankind would have ever done that. It was a dream. It was something we would never have. But today, there are more than 100,000 flights that take off and land safely every single day. But that really doesn't turn our heads either. It's just become part of everyday life. I had the opportunity to meet a very well-known Christian band recently, and they have been known for many, many number one hits. And they were asked the question, do those songs move you the way that they move everybody else? And they said, honestly, we have to say no. Because once you've sang that song 10,000 times, it starts to lose its impact. And that's how it goes. The more we have something, the more it's around, the more familiar it becomes, the less impressive it is. And just like that can happen with things, it can happen with people. Kind of like the college student who was forced to take his mother's English class in school. And one of the other students came up to him and said, what is it like to live with Dr. Jones? She's authored books. She speaks on this. She's published in articles and journals. And she goes to conferences and people call her for advice. And you live with her. What is that like? To which the son replied, well, I don't know who that is. At home, we just kind of call her mom. But that's how it goes. It happens with things. It happens with people. The more common they are, the less impressive they are. It also happens with God. The more common we make God, the less special he becomes. You remember in John chapter 6 when Jesus had just given his I am the bread of life discourse. And right after he said, I am the bread of life, it says in John 6 verse 42, they said, the Jews around him, is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, the carpenter whose father and mother we know? It says in the very next chapter, John 5, not even his brothers believed him. Remember, these were people that knew the story of his birth. They knew his parents. They watched him grow up. They watched him take his first steps and speak his first words. They watched his mother change his diaper. Maybe Jesus was colicky. We have no idea, but they were intimately familiar with his life. And he was just this kid down the street. And so when he shows up and said, "I am the Son of God here to take away the sins of the world," they say, "You mean that kid that we watched go around the block all these years? We've been with him all this time. What does he mean?" In fact, Jesus says in Luke chapter 4, no prophet is accepted in his hometown for that very reason. The more we're around a person, a thing, the more familiar it is, the less special it is. And that's the problem that David is having as we come into our passage this morning. You see, by the time we get to this part in the story, God has been with David a long time. He's been working with David a long time. He's done miracles in David's life, things that would just stop us in our tracks, but he's been doing them for David a long time. By this point, David has already defeated Goliath, a miracle that he did through the power of God. He's been crowned and anointed king of Israel, which God said he could have. He's defeated the sons of Saul in a civil war that erupted when King Saul died. None of that was possible without God, and so God was with David every step of his life. In fact, God did so much through David, and David won so many victories because of the Lord's work. People sang songs about it. In 1 Samuel chapter 18, it says, "Saul has killed his thousands, and David his tens of thousands." Like I said, God has been with David, and David has become close to God. But David has also started becoming complacent with God. A little too familiar, a little too comfortable. And we see that happen in 2 Samuel chapter 6. Look at verse 1 with me. David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim. When I was in high school and we were moving from Ohio to Albuquerque, we went out to Albuquerque to kind of see the town, and we visited what would become my high school. And we're walking through the campus, they're giving us this tour, and we just kind of stopped where we were because we realized that from that point, we had an absolutely perfect view of the Sandia Mountain and all of the colors and all of the ridges and all of the light and all the reflections. From right there, it was a perfect view. And we were amazed. We were from Ohio. We didn't have mountains in Ohio. This was cool. And so we asked the guide, "Do you all ever stop and just appreciate that mountain?" And he said, "Well, to be honest with you, we usually forget it's there because it's just there all the time." And that's how it goes. When we see something a lot and it becomes familiar to us like that, we stop appreciating it the way we used to. And when that happens, something is lost. Because there is joy in appreciation. There is joy in looking at the majesty of God's creation. There's joy in looking at a great piece of artwork or listening to a beautiful song. There is joy in appreciating something like that. And the more we're around it, the less we notice. I have to say that when I first got to the church, I would spend a lot of time looking out the window in my office because I have a spectacular view of the hills right outside. But I also have to admit that I look at that less and less. It's less special. Not that it is less special, but to me it's just become too common. Because the more common something becomes, the less interesting it becomes. Which brings us to our first truth of the morning. Overfamiliarity removes joy. Look at verse 3. "And they carried the ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were driving the new cart with the ark of God, and Ahio went before the ark. And David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. And when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen had stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him down there because of his error, and he died there beside the ark of God. Now, a lot of people come to that passage and they read that story and they go, wow. And they're shocked that God actually killed a man simply for touching the ark. And I have to admit that at first glance, it does seem a bit surprising until we stop and think about everything that's going on. First of all, Uzzah had no business even moving the ark in the first place. If you remember, that job was reserved for the Levites, and specifically, it was reserved for the house of Kohath within the tribe of Levi. It says in Numbers chapter 3, their guard duty, the house of Kohath, their guard duty involved the ark, the table, the lampstand, the altars, the vessels of the sanctuary, and the screen, and all the service connected with these. That was their job. Uzzah isn't a Levite. Uzzah isn't of the house of Kohath, and yet Uzzah is moving the ark. He had no business doing it. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if you remember how God said that ark was supposed to be moved. He says in Exodus chapter 25, you shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold, and you shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark by them. It was a burden to be borne by men, by people, to carry this ark wherever they went. It wasn't supposed to be thrown on some cart. Sure, it was a new cart. Great, but it was a cart. And it was hauled by an oxen. And so what they have done is they are now moving this ark in a way that God didn't specify. So that's strike two. And then it comes to the final straw, and Uzzah reaches out and touches it. And a lot of people would say, well, but he's just protecting it. It was about to fall. The oxen had stumbled. What's so wrong with that? The only thing is the Bible doesn't say it was falling. It just says the oxen stumbled. And so I can kind of imagine as Uzzah is walking beside this ark on a cart, the oxen loses its footing just a little bit, and he reaches up his hand just to kind of keep it steady as he's walking along and treats it like a common moving box. God said in Numbers chapter 4, they must not touch the holy things lest they die. And so Uzzah was moving the ark, but he wasn't a Levite. He put it on a cart instead of the poles. And then he reaches out and touches it like it's some ordinary item. And God said, enough is enough is enough. And he strikes him dead. But here's the thing. Uzzah committed the sin. Uzzah violated the law. Uzzah was punished for his actions, but David allowed it to happen. David was the king. It was David's watch. David was in charge. And David allowed this culture of contempt to develop toward God that led to Uzzah's sin and led to this comfort and led to this over-familiarity and led to this attitude of contempt. You see, the more familiar a person gets with God, the less fearful that person is of God. It's that old saying again, that familiarity breeds contempt. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying live your life in fear of God. I'm not saying run and hide from God every time you make a mistake. That's not what we're talking about. In fact, the Bible says very clearly that if a person has placed their faith in Jesus Christ, they don't need to fear God ever again. He has changed from judge to father. And so that's not what we're talking about. But what we are saying is that no matter how close we get to God, no matter how personal we get with God, we must always remember that He is God, that He is holy, that He is righteous. And that's what the Bible means when it says the fear of the Lord. It's a healthy respect for the God who created the heavens and the earth. And I have to say that the fear of the Lord isn't something we hear much about these days. Not in this culture, not in this world. The fear of the Lord is kind of an absent thought. Nowadays, it's all about love and grace and mercy and forgiveness. And by all means, we should focus on that. Jesus focused on that. It says in 1 John chapter 4 that God is love. It says in John chapter 3 that he loved us so much he sent his only son to die on a cross on our behalf so that we can come back to him and get close. So we're not saying don't get close with God. What we're saying is that we can't appreciate the love and the mercy and the forgiveness without at the same time appreciating the holiness and the righteousness. David said in Psalm 111, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." And let me just say that anytime the fear of the Lord is lost, it always leads to problems. For example, one of the things the Bible speaks about very clearly is abstinence before marriage, abstaining from sexual relations before marriage. But according to recent studies, 97% of all Americans won't. But look at what has come from that. STDs have skyrocketed. Abortions have skyrocketed. Single-parent homes have skyrocketed. The amount of poverty has skyrocketed. Or think about addiction for a minute. The Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6, "All things are lawful, but I will not be brought under the power of any." And I really like how the English Standard Version puts it, "All things are lawful, but I will not be dominated by anything." And yet every single day, people hand over control of their lives to drugs, to alcohol, to gambling, to pornography. And in the United States alone, we spend more than $100 billion a year battling addiction and battling the consequences and battling the fallout from all of that. One person once said, "The more we do as we please, the less we are pleased with what we do." And it's absolutely true, because I don't know about you, but I don't find much joy in the problems that come with doing as I please. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not picking on any person. I'm not picking on a group. But what I am saying is that it's hard to deny the majority of the issues we see in the world can be traced backwards through a culture that has lost its fear of the Lord. You see, for too many people these days, God is just an idea. He's just a myth. He's just a topic. He's just another word to use when we're surprised or we're angry or we're shocked or we're cursing at somebody. And so over-familiarity removes joy. But observation realigns joy. Look at verse 8. "And David was angry because the Lord had broken out against Uzzah. And that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of the Lord that day. And he said, 'How can the ark of the Lord come to me?' So David was not willing to take the ark of the Lord into the city of David. But David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. And the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household." In our living room is a wood stove that we use to heat our house in the wintertime. Many of you probably have something very similar at your house. But we burn wood all winter. We start a fire about November. We put it out about April. Needless to say, a lot of wood gets put through that engine. And with all of that, we're messing with that wood stove all the time. We're cleaning it. We're adjusting it. We're feeding it. We're doing something with it. And I have to admit that from time to time, every now and then, I get a little too comfortable with it, a little too complacent. And I'm not careful enough, and I bump my hand against the piece of metal or a brick or an ash or something, and I burn my hand. And it's enough to make me step back and observe my situation, to figure out what is it that I had just done. It gets my attention. And you might say that the very same thing is happening to David. He got a little too comfortable, a little too complacent with God, and he got burned. But now he's taking a step back, and he's looking at what's going on, and he's observing what's going on. And it doesn't say it here, but when we read this story in 1 Chronicles chapter 15, it tells us that for the 3 months the ark was at Obed-Edom's house, David was actually researching the scriptures to find out what had happened. And in that research, he discovers his mistake. It says in 1 Chronicles 15, David summoned the priests and said to them, "You are the heads of the Levites. Because you did not carry it the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us because we did not seek him according to the rule. But what was that rule? The rule was to respect the ark of God. The rule was to respect the Lord himself. And instead, David got too comfortable, too complacent. He cut corners. He did things differently. And all of that respect all but disappeared. You see, love and respect go hand in hand. They can't be separated. Jesus said in John 14, "If you love me, you'll keep my commandments." In other words, if we really love Jesus the way we say we do, and I mean the way we say we do on Facebook and the way we say we do on our bumper stickers, if we really love Jesus the way we say we do, we'll have the respect for him to do as he asks. And that's what David is figuring out. That's the lesson that David is learning. God gave very clear instructions when it came to this ark. And out of love for God, David is going to keep those rules. That's a lesson, by the way, that he seems to remember all throughout his life. Because in Psalm 25, he writes, "The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him." Everybody here knows what it's like to work for somebody or to be under someone else's authority, to have to follow someone else's lead. We know what it's like to go to work and do things the boss's way because it's the boss's business. It's his company. And so he gets to decide how his company is run. And none of that is new to us. And so it shouldn't surprise us to hear that when it comes to God's work and when it comes to God's worship, that God gets to decide how it's done. After all, this is his church. He built it. Jesus said in Matthew 16, verse 18, "On this rock of truth, I will build my church." This is his. And if it's his church, it only makes sense that he gets to say how things are done in his church. And so David got too complacent with that. He got too comfortable, too familiar. God was with him a long time, doing things with him a long time. God made a covenant with David. David was God's man. The Bible says David was a man after God's own heart. And so David got comfortable in that role. But then he got burned. And he took a step back. And he's observing what happened. He's learning the rules. He's learning what God said. And he's ready to try again. So over-familiarity removes joy because we can't appreciate something fully when it's too common. Observation realigns joy because it makes us search for God's will and search for what he said and bring our life in accordance with his plan. And third, obedience releases joy. Look at verse 12. "And it was told King David, 'The Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God.' So David went and brought up the ark of God from inside the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And with those who bore the ark of the Lord had gone six steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fatted animal. And David danced before the Lord with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the horn." You ever seen a person living their life on fire for God? And I'm not talking about a little bit excited. I'm talking about on fire, overfilling with the joy of the Lord to the point that they almost look weird. You ever seen somebody like that? You show me a person living like that, I'll show you a person living their life in obedience to God's plan. Notice in our passage this morning that as soon as David saw that God had blessed Obed-Edom and his household for his obedience, and he realized that the Lord rewards an obedient and a faithful heart, he was so filled with joy that right then and there he does his own happy dance. And a lot of people think that this point in David's life is when he wrote Psalm 68, because in Psalm 68, he says, "The righteous shall be glad. They shall exult before God. They shall be jubilant with joy. His name is the Lord. Exult before him." And that is a heart filled with joy. And let me just say, there is nothing better than a heart filled with the joy of the Lord. I'm a Broncos fan when it comes to the NFL. I admit it. I'm sorry if you're an Eagles fan. I'm not converting. It's been a year and a half. Isn't going to happen. I enjoy the Denver Broncos, and I was blessed to be able to see them play a couple times against the Cincinnati Bengals. Now, I have been to I don't know how many professional baseball games, and what I was expecting was something more on par with that. People were kind of in the stands and eating their hot dogs and watching the game at the park, but I was met with something very different. At an NFL game, that, I have to say, is the loudest place I have ever been in my life. People cheer just to cheer. But when their team does something, like scores, or there's a turnover, or a first down, or a sack, the fans of that team are on their feet, and they're shouting, and they're cheering, and they're dancing. And what if the church worshiped like that? What if the church was filled with as much joy as an NFL fan? The Bible says David was. It says he was dancing before the Lord with all his might. But notice what else it says. He was in a linen ephod. He was in his underwear. Remember, David was a king. And kings wore robes and sashes and crowns and jewelry. And they came with a procession. And there was the dignity. But in the presence of God, he sets all of that aside. And none of it matters. And he stands right there and dances with all his might. The show had stopped, and he was there as he was. And that's how God wants you. God wants you to come as you are, to forget the show, forget the pretense. He's not interested in the tie or the jacket or how shiny the shoes are, and there's nothing wrong with those things, but God is more interested in you than your clothing. Listen, there's a lot of churches throughout the world filled with people put together on the outside who are falling apart on the inside. They're so caught up in doing it the right way and avoiding doing the wrong thing, and I don't want to offend them and I don't want to disappoint them, that they lose all the joy of worship. When I proposed to my wife, I took her out to a restaurant that was recommended to us from the friend that introduced us. It was one of those restaurants in upscale downtown Albuquerque that you had to have a reservation to get in. You had to dress almost in a suit and tie to go there because jeans, they wouldn't let you in the door. And so we made a reservation. We got there. We got our table. And out comes the waiter. It's one of those places, the waiter's in a tuxedo with his bow tie. And his arm is out. And there's the white napkin over his arm and the bottle of wine in the other hand. And the menu's in French. And we don't know what we're ordering. And I tell you, I've never been as nervous in anything as I was right then and there. The guy looked at us with total contempt when we asked if they sold like cheeseburgers or something, because we had no idea. We left there hungrier than we walked in. And we joke about it now, but I have to tell you that then and there, we were so worried we would mess up, we didn't enjoy any of it. We left and we went to a burger joint and actually had a good time. God doesn't care about the show. He doesn't care about the formalities. He doesn't care about the rituals. He cares about the heart. He cares about the person. He cares about you coming as you are and worshiping with all your might. And maybe you're sitting here and you're thinking, that's what I want. I don't want to be caught up in all the rules and the ritual, and I got to wear this or I don't wear that, and I do it in this order or that order. I said the wrong thing. I want to have the type of relationship with God that David had, where he could worship no matter what was going on. I want that kind of joy. I can tell you, friend, you can have it. It is there for you to have, but we have to have it God's way. We have to come with an obedient heart. And an obedient heart is a heart that will be filled with the type of joy that we read about this morning, because that is the type of heart that the Lord rewards, and that is the joy of obedience.